950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. FYI Politics with Brett Johnson here on a Wednesday afternoon. Coming up on the show today, restaurants possibly reopening in Minnesota. Also, Trump proud about coronavirus testing numbers around the country. Why wasn't rental assistance passed during the last legislative session? And progressive Democrats facing primary challenges. We'll talk more about that all coming up on the show today. We'll also be joined by Professor David Schultz at the bottom of the hour to get his political analysis on all of the news of the day. Joined along by Eric Nelson on the other side of the production glass. Eric, how are things going for you in there today?
Oh, just peachy.
Just peachy.
Yeah,
all right.
Well.
No big announcements from you, huh?
None that I can think of. No,
all right. All right. Should point out that Governor Tim Walz was going to give a press conference on what was going to happen with restaurants reopening on June 1st, but that got pushed back until 3 o'clock, so I'm sure Matt will have some coverage on his show in regards to what's going to be happening with these restaurants. So June 1st is the date to watch for. Walz announced this last week that beginning on June 1st, he would allow restaurants to begin reopening with some restrictions. Now, we don't exactly know what those restrictions are going to be. I imagine they'll have something to do with the amount of people that restaurants will be allowed to have within their establishments, probably some sort of percentage of capacity. Like, for instance, right now, retail stores are able to operate with 50% capacity. I'm sure we'll get guidance on that from his announcement, where we'll hear that restaurants can operate at X percentage capacity, and they'll probably face some other rules that they'll have to follow. But I don't know, Eric, I was talking about this with Patrick yesterday. I'm in no rush to get back to dine-in eating at restaurants. I mean, I might eventually do it in a few weeks or a few months, but at least for these first few days, once June starts, I don't think you're going to be finding me at a restaurant. I think I'll take more of a wait-and-see approach. How about you?
I don't know. I'm eager to get back out into
You're pretty eager?
The world.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just feel like there could be such a rush in those first few days, like what we saw in Wisconsin, that I might hold off a few days just to see how things go. But
yeah,
I am with
you,
though.
There will probably be a rush and it will be crowded. In that case,
yeah,
I can skip it. But
I mean, I might find myself back out there in a few weeks or a few months. There's a few establishments I enjoy going to, especially during the summertime, that I wouldn't mind getting back to, especially ones that offer patio seating. I would feel like that would be
yeah.
a lot safer sitting on a patio and in an outdoor setting rather than being at an indoor place. But I suppose even at an indoor place, especially if you're at an establishment that has booths, I would probably feel more comfortable in that scenario than just having a bunch of tables set out. But we'll see what happens with that announcement coming up. That'll be 3 o'clock with his press conference. Matt will have more on that with his show, so make sure you stay tuned for that, since that could certainly help the restaurant industry in the state. All right, let's move to the news for today and pass along numbers in Minnesota for COVID-19. Always kind of depressing to do these numbers, but yeah, I want to report these nonetheless to make sure you're staying up to date on the information. So after a big surge in terms of hospitalizations yesterday in Minnesota, we only saw a slight increase today. The alarming thing we saw yesterday was that hospitalizations jumped from 488 to 545. Well, today we only saw an increase of 5 more people, as it's now reported that 550 have been admitted to hospitals around Minnesota, including 212 who are in the ICU. So at least the increase wasn't quite as big as we saw yesterday. Then we also did have 29 new deaths that were reported in the state. So latest update on the numbers in Minnesota, taking a look at the total number of cases that we have in the state. If I can pull up that number for you, we are now at 17,000. 670. And the big thing to watch, I brought this up yesterday too, is I don't really pay attention to the total number of cases. I don't think that's a really helpful number. I think you're better off looking at deaths and also hospitalizations, since really the total number of cases depends on how many tests that are being administered. And even then, if you go beyond that and look at hospitalizations and mortality rates, then you still have to consider, well, are states even reporting those numbers accurately? And as we've talked about in the past, some states are doing a better job than others on those. The ones doing the worst job mostly are coming in the South, with states like Florida and Georgia. I still can't get over that graph that Georgia released last week where they had their dates listed out of order, which was just hilarious how they went from...
I mean, why don't they just put the y-axis as the day of the week?
Yeah, yeah. Just flip it all around completely. And
well, this day was only the 19th, so it's only 19 high.
just wild stuff. So latest update on COVID-19 in Minnesota. So I guess if you want to call it slightly good news, our hospitalizations, new hospitalizations, weren't quite as high as they were yesterday. Let's get to some local news now. So Peter Callahan over in MinnPost, who working on getting back on the show. In fact, I might try to get him on to talk about this subject we're going to get to in just a second, possibly on tomorrow's show. But he wrote a pretty detailed piece about why rental assistance never got passed during this last legislative session. Now, the House, which is controlled by the DFL, was fully on board with passing a rental and mortgage assistance program to, of course, help people that are having trouble paying their bills with what's been happening with the pandemic. But the Senate side, surprise, surprise, is where the snag came up. The Senate chamber, of course, is controlled by Republicans by a very narrow 35-32 margin. Now, it appeared in the final days of the session that we were going to get an agreement. A $100 million rental assistance agreement. Republicans had agreed to this. Democrats looked like they were on board. But then negotiations hit a snag. And it was over something that really had nothing to do with providing rental assistance. So Democrats wanted $100 million in rental assistance to fund low-income Minnesotans impacted by the fallout of the pandemic. And they also wanted a sizable investment in affordable housing, which was part of the legislation, and even some Republicans were on board of that with a compromise that they were going to make. And I think that's an important investment to make there, too, that affordable housing money, since there are, well, tons of luxury condos and luxury apartments getting built that, for the most part, are operating at maybe half capacity.
Yeah, and that's even a lot of their business models is, we know we can have a certain amount of vacancy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's just infuriating sometimes when you have those types of luxury apartments that are only operating, with very few people that are actually living in the units, and yet they're still able to be profitable. In fact, there is one of those types of buildings. I won't, of course, name where I live specifically, but I do live across from an apartment building that is considered a luxury apartment. And I'm trying to think of the rental price I saw last year. You could get a 500-square-foot studio apartment for $1,600 a month. What a deal.
And all those luxury apartments, they don't really offer any sort of luxury as far as I can tell. The really nice ones might have a gym.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some laundry rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I don't know how they coined the term luxury.
As far as I can tell, with the ones that I live across from, I guess you get really big windows, which is kind of a cool feature. But is that really worth like an extra $800 of rent?
Yeah.
And having a sauna area. They do have kind of this cool sauna thing with surrounded all by windows. But again, an extra $800.
Yeah, pay for a gym membership, I guess.
Yeah. I've always wondered this about luxury apartments. If you're going to pay $1,600 for a 500-square-foot studio apartment, if you can afford to do that, why are you renting and not buying? That never makes any sense to me. If you have that much money, you should be buying a property so you can try to make some money back. I don't get why someone would rent an apartment unit if you can afford that much money. I suppose maybe if you're living somewhere temporarily, but there can't really be that many people that are doing that. So
I think in this economy, it's really hard to say for sure that you're going to be anywhere for more than the next year.
Mm-hmm. But even then, if you still buy a property, you still get part of that money back. That's an advantage of buying over renting, and why most financial analysts and financial advisors always tell people that if you have the ability, you should buy instead of rent. So
that is true, but it's just it's a lot more of a mental strain on you having to worry about taking care of a property, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Well, in that case, you can do like what I've done. I have a homeowners association. Of course, I pay a fee for that, but then I generally don't have to worry about some of those aspects. But that's an entirely different discussion. Let's get back to what's happening at the legislature, though, and why they weren't able to pass this $100 million of rental assistance. So the GOP, in the final days of the session, sounds like a theme we talked about on Monday's show with Senate Minority Leader Susan Kent when she was saying Republicans were stuffing all sorts of provisions into bills at the very last second. So the part of the GOP proposal that they were putting into this rental assistance bill that DFLers weren't very happy about was a series of measures that sought to reduce regulations on housing construction that have been sought by housing developers and ideas that have come out of an interim committee that was chaired by Richard Draheim, or let me see if I'm saying his name right. I think it's Draheim is how you pronounce his name. He is a Republican from Madison Lake. Apologies to Rich if I'm saying your name incorrectly. So write your hate mail to Brett Johnson here at AM 950 if I said your name incorrectly. So they basically wanted to reform regulations on building permits around the state of Minnesota. And DFLers weren't quite on board with this because, well, A, none of these provisions had been debated in the Senate whatsoever. And then they were also not quite happy that many local cities were not happy with these regulations that were going to be reformed, because essentially what they would do, I won't get into the details since that's going to get really dry quickly, is that it would essentially just preempt cities on their ability to regulate housing permits and housing regulations. So that's what a lot of local cities were unhappy about. So that's what led overall to this housing and rental assistance program falling apart, which would have been $100 million. And I did a little math on this. $100 million, would that really help many Minnesotans? And it turns out not really when I run the math on this. So the latest estimate I saw was that there are 590,000 Minnesotans that currently rent apartments. This was just a quick Google search I did like 2 minutes before the show, so who knows if that number is 100% accurate, but let's say it is, right around 600,000 renters in Minnesota. Well, if we provide $100 million in rental assistance, and that's assuming all $100 million is going towards rental assistance, which I'm guessing is not the case, but for the sake of argument, let's say that is the very scenario we're talking about. Each renter would get a grand total of $169, a three-figure amount. That's really not going to help very much for paying rent, a check for $169.
Yeah, that's a one-time thing.
Yeah, $100 million is what they were proposing for funding, yeah. Now, of course, you could make the argument, well, some of these 590,000 renters might not be getting assistance because they are of the upper income bracket. Well, even if you double that amount of $170 or $169 to around, what, $340?
Yeah.
That's still not really doing a whole lot. Ultimately, and this is something that probably needs to happen at the federal level if you're going to have some sort of rental and mortgage assistance program, I just don't know that at the state level you're going to have state governments be able to fund this on their own, since it would be an enormous amount of money that you would need to provide in order to get people the funding they would need to be able to stay into homes. So something that would probably need to happen at the federal level but is unlikely to, well, ever happen given the current composition over in Congress. But we could do a little bit better than $100 million on rental assistance, since that comes to a grand total of a check of $169 to each Minnesota renter. We'll come on back with another segment here on FYI Politics. I have a few more local stories to get to and also a few national headlines. And again, coming up at the bottom of the hour, we'll have Professor David Schultz getting his political analysis on all the news of the day. Stay with us here on the show.
Hi, Alex of Better Futures Minnesota. Does your business or organization need janitorial services, lawn care, or snow services? Obtain a free, no-obligation estimate from Better Futures Minnesota when you mention that you heard about us on AM 950. our supervised, hardworking, and affordable crews will handle your interior and exterior building and property maintenance needs while you help men in your community transform their lives and walk on a positive path to success. It's a win-win. To learn more, go to betterfuturesminnesota.com under Business Services.
Hi, I'm Matt McNeil, and I want to encourage you to join me weekday afternoons at 3 p.m. for The Matt McNeil Show. It's a Twin Cities-based full hour of talk where we discuss what's going on in the state and in the nation from a Minnesota perspective. We'll be joined by a lot of great guests, and we'll take your phone calls. Interact with us on the Twitter page, at Matt McNeil Show, the Facebook page, Progressive Citizen X, The Matt McNeil Show, and on email, comment at am950radio.com. The Matt McNeil Show, weekday afternoons at 3, right here on AM 950. At Rudy Luther Toyota, the health and safety of their customers and employees is the top priority. They continue to take extreme precautions to keep everyone safe. Like many businesses in Minnesota, Rudy Luther Toyota is starting to move forward. They have a huge selection of new and certified used Toyotas, and Toyota has announced 0% APR financing for up to 60 months for qualified buyers on several of their most popular models, like my favorite, the new RAV4. You can even take up to 90 days to make your first payment. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 west of Minneapolis, and online at rudyluther.com.
Hey, it's Brett from FYI Politics. Thanks to everyone who has signed up for an AM950 membership. And due to that great response, we've launched a member content page on AM950radio.com that will feature exclusive bonus podcasts from Matt McNeil and monthly interviews with Tom Hartman. If you've signed up for a membership, just check your email inbox for your passcode, then head over to AM950radio.com, click member content, and then enter your passcode. And if you don't have a membership yet, it's not too late. Just go to AM950radio.com to sign up.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop. OP.
Unbeatable appliance prices. Then Warner Stellion saves you an additional 5%. Exclusive savings on laundry pairs, dishwashers, French door refrigerators, and more kitchen suites than you can count. Buy appliances online, by phone, or in store. And Warner Stellion guarantees your price, plus saves you 5% more. Warner Stellion's trusted delivery specialists ensure your new appliances get delivered and installed right. Shop online, by phone, or in store, and save an extra 5% from the specialists at Warner Stellion.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, Wednesday edition of the show. Coming up at 3 o'clock, we are going to be getting Governor Tim Walz making an announcement updating us on how restaurants will be able to reopen coming up on June 1st. He'll provide detail on that with his press conference. Matt should have more on that with his show, which of course airs from 3 until 4 p.m. Getting back into some local news, the city of Eveleth, which of course is in northern Minnesota, is the latest city to declare itself, I love this name, a constitutional and business-friendly community. That was a resolution that was passed by their city council. What this effectively, you got to chime in about that name, don't you? Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to know what this entailed. Are they just declaring it?
They're declaring it, yeah, that they are going to be a constitutional and business-friendly community, and it effectively would allow restaurants and other businesses to open up without any restrictions. And the way they can do that is that this city council resolution directs law enforcement not to enforce the governor's stay safe order.
Okay.
So that's how they're able to do it. Yeah, of course, they can't repeal the stay safe order since that is done at a state level, but Eveleth does join other Minnesota cities that have done this, including Lakefield in southern Minnesota, Pequot Lakes, which is located near Brainerd, if you're not familiar, and Cokato Township, which is just a little bit west of the Twin Cities. So those are among the cities that have passed similar resolutions in recent weeks that pretty much say they are going to let local businesses open as they wish, largely without any restrictions. And like I was saying, they'll do this by having law enforcement not enforce the stay safe order. So I'm not necessarily looking for agreement with people I might disagree with, including on this thing right here with these local cities passing these orders defying the stay safe order. I would look more for consistency sometimes on political positions. And here's what I mean by this. What I'm guessing is that a lot of the conservatives that probably sit on these local city councils are probably very upset at cities like Minneapolis and others around the country that declare themselves, let's say, sanctuary cities. Where, of course, in sanctuary cities like Minneapolis, local law enforcement is not going to be, well, doing ICE's job, which, of course, is a federal agency. So I think there's a little bit of inconsistency right there, being that they're upset that bigger cities like Minneapolis aren't going to enforce federal immigration laws. Well, that's not even the best way to put it. They're just not going to be doing ICE's job for them. But then in their local cities, they say, well, we're not going to enforce state laws. Now, of course, there is a difference between what's happening in these local cities versus what happens in sanctuary cities, including Minneapolis and others around the country. The big difference being is that, well, in sanctuary cities, like I was saying, they're essentially just directing the cops not to do the job of ICE when it should be ICE asking people about their immigration status, if at all. So I think that's an entirely different scenario. But
or even more than that, just turning over random information to ICE, mm-hmm. like people who receive rental help or food stamps, things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so even then, it's not even a perfect analogy, but I'm sure a lot of these folks who are in these city councils and these city chambers that are saying, all right, well, we're going to be a constitutional city, and therefore we are not going to enforce a state order, they're probably the same ones that are very upset about sanctuary cities. And as you and I just talked about, there is some legitimacy to sanctuary cities, being that it shouldn't be them doing the job of, well, the federal government. We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. If you'd like to chime in on the conversation, we'll have open phone lines for the next couple of minutes before we get David Schultz coming up here at the bottom of the hour. Now let's move on to some national news for today and some disturbing figures that were just estimated by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Review Office. They have to do with unemployment numbers that we could be seeing into 2021. And yeah, they are not good, according to the Congressional Budget Office. We've often heard the narrative from lots of elected officials and people who are economists saying, well, we expect a V-shaped downturn and a V-shaped recovery, meaning we'll have a very fast downturn, which of course we did. But then on the other side of the V, since a V is obviously a very sharp letter, that means we'll have a quick recovery, hence the V-shaped economic downturn and recovery that they're predicting. Although most times when you have economic turmoil, you get more of a U-shape where you have a very gradual recovery, which is what we saw after the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009. Well, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released their latest estimates on what could be happening with the unemployment rate into next year, and it's ugly. They are expecting an unemployment rate going into 2021 to be above 10%. For a good portion of the year. In fact, they say unemployment is going to average 9.3% next year. Agency says it will peak around 15.8% next quarter, drop to 11.5% by the end of this year, and then hover right around 10% for most of 2021 before it'll drop to about 8.6% at the end of 2021. So
I have no idea how they make these projections, though. Because we really have no idea what's going to happen in the future with the coronavirus.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, these are probably even conservative estimates as well. Not conservative politically, but conservative in the number of people that they're probably thinking are going to remain employed that likely won't. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what their projections were like in the fall of 2008 when we were just in the beginning stages of the Great Recession, to see if they were saying, oh yeah, by 2010, we're going to have an unemployment rate of 4%, which, by the way, never happened. In fact, if you look back at figures with the unemployment rate going back to the Great Recession, we didn't even get below an 8% unemployment rate until September of 2012. Took almost all the way until Barack Obama's reelection campaign for us to get that unemployment rate. below 9%. And that's kind of scary to think about when you consider that this downturn is probably much bigger than what we experienced in 08 and 09.
And when you consider that they've altered the rules for what qualifies as being unemployed.
Yeah.
It's, you know, they've redefined it so that they can lower their numbers.
Mm-hmm. And the unemployment rate is only one indicator you should look at, because if people just give up on finding work altogether, where
exactly, that's what I mean. Yeah,
they're not counted. Yeah, they're not counted in that figure whatsoever. Hey, let's talk to Gary in Minneapolis before we head to our conversation with Professor David Schultz. Gary, what's on your mind today?
Quite a few of them bosses, maybe the majority of them, they like a lot of unemployment because you got to be a complete yes man. They're like dictators almost, and they'll tell you, if you don't like your job, get up in here. We'll kick the 100 guys who stand outside waiting for your job. But what I called about some good news, Biden announced, it was on the YouTube today, Whitman, the governor, the lady governor of Michigan.
Oh, Gretchen Whitmer, yes.
She might be one. And then the other one's good, too, the granddaughter of Cesar Chavez. She'll get a lot of the Latin voters out to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's certainly looking at a number of names. I saw another one that was being floated, which was Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth.
Yeah, who, she'd be good. He's got to figure out which one he thinks should take over if something happens to him, you know, if or after 4 years, which one would be more qualified to be president. And at the same time, which one would help win the election the best. Because if we're stuck with Trump the next 4 years, we're going to be in a heck of a lot of trouble. You know, look at McConnell. Get him out of there, too. He's holding up money for the states, you know, so that the states will go bankrupt, you know, and then there'll be massive unemployment and stuff.
All right. Appreciate the phone call there, Gary. The one thing I will disagree with on Gary on this, and this is something because it's kind of a loaded topic that I won't necessarily get into on the show, but if you were to give a scenario to me where Democrats were to able to win the Senate but have Trump win the White House, that's actually my dream scenario for what would happen. And it has largely to do with the fact that whoever controls the White House is largely guaranteed to lose just about every other race going forward, whether you're talking about Congress or the local and the state level. But that's maybe something we'll cover on another future show, because there's also a lot of power in the Senate, where the Senate, if you don't have that, if you have the presidency and but you don't have the Senate, you're not getting anything passed, since the Senate, of course, not only can block legislation, but they can also block judicial appointments and cabinet appointments. There's an inordinate amount of power in the Senate.
This is an aside, but did you see the clip of where Stacey Abrams was on the news with Joe Biden, and she probably thought she was going to be announced as the vice presidential pick?
Oh, no.
And you could just see someone die behind their eyes in real time.
That never bodes well for anyone who tries to actively campaign for the vice presidency.
Yeah. Play it chill a little bit.
Because I would get it from the perspective of being the presidential nominee, is that you don't want to reward someone who's actively campaigning. Yeah, it just doesn't have very good optics.
No one wants to vote for someone who's extremely desperate and shows that they'll do anything to win.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not necessarily a knock against Stacey Abrams and her politics, although, to be quite honest, I don't even know a whole lot about her politics, which is kind of true of all of these vice presidential potential picks that Biden is making, is that we largely don't know a whole lot about them in terms of their politics. But I think Gary did make a good point that whoever is named as his VP, if Biden wins, will probably be taking over the White House by 2024 or perhaps even sooner. So it's a very, very important pick. And maybe we'll talk more about this with David coming up in the next segment. Again, that'll be David Schultz, Hamline University political science professor. We'll be chatting with him about all the news of the day and political strategy. So that's coming up next here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Minnehaha Falls Landscaping creates outdoor environments that grow beauty and support health and wellness. We provide everything needed for people and pollinators to grow healthy together in the home landscape. Contact us for landscape renovations, patios, walkways, retaining walls, butterfly gardens, rain gardens, and bee lawns. Minnehaha Falls Landscaping is a business rooted in healthy soil. We rely on soil health to beautify landscapes, restore ecosystems, and protect pollinators. We love sharing our soil secrets with everyone. Visit us at MinnehahaFallsLandscape.com.
Hey, it's Brett from FYI Politics, and I want to thank you for listening to AM 950. The advertisers you hear are what allows us to stay on the airwaves, and unfortunately, some of them are going to be going through some tough times with the coronavirus. So support our advertisers in any way you can, whether that's ordering takeout food from one of our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants, purchasing gift cards, or just contacting them and telling them thanks for supporting AM 950. Even the littlest thing you can do can go a long way. Find a full list of our advertisers at am950radio.com. And thanks for listening.
Hi, everyone. Matt McNeil here to say thanks for keeping your radio tuned to AM 950 during this crisis. I also wanted to thank everyone from the bottom of my heart who's become a member of AM 950 over the last few weeks. It's so important to keep AM 950 on the air, maintaining a progressive radio voice in Minnesota for 2020. We feature the best in progressive talk and great local hosts like Brett Johnson, Robert Pilot, and myself. We started our membership program to make sure AM 950 got through this trying time, and you, the listener, have responded. Thank you so very much. You can become a member by simply heading over to am950radio.com and donating. The membership response has been so great, we're planning on launching some brand new members-only content, starting with some great new interviews. Tom Hartman will have a regular monthly members-only interview, and we'll have new member content updated weekly. Head over to am950radio.com and declare, yes, I want to support AM950. For everyone who is a member, thank you so very much for your support, and thanks for listening to the progressive voice of Minnesota, AM 950.
My part-time service in the Army National Guard makes it possible for me to be more for the community I call home. I'm a better neighbor because my service has taught me how important it is to be a team player. My training helps me in my classes when I give attention to detail to the task at hand. My service also allows me to be there for my community in ways others can't. I help my hometown recover after nature strikes. My service in the Army National Guard allows me to keep my country and those I care about safe from threats. I also work with a network of professionals that help me succeed. Also, the Army National Guard's education benefits make getting a higher education a reality. Being an Army National Guard soldier makes living and serving in my community more rewarding every day. Learn more about how you too can live and serve part-time close to home by visiting NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
With your AM 950 weather, this is Eric Nelson. Today will be sunny with a high near 77. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 58. Thursday, cloudy with a high of 74 and a low of 60. Friday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. with a high of 75 and a low of 61. With the state having closed bars and restaurants for dining in, it's especially important that you support our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants, featuring high-quality local foods, unique dishes, vegetarian options, and so much more. These restaurants are locally owned, so the money you spend stays local. Find all the restaurants offering takeout at eatlocalminnesota.com.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, and we're joined now by our political analysis expert. That is Professor David Schultz, political science professor over at Hamline University, who joins us now on the show. You can find his blog over at schultzestake.blogspot.com. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you today?
Hey, doing good. Glad you could take some time to join us. I want to get your thoughts on a number of big political news stories that, of course, have been happening over the past few weeks. Never a shortage of topics to talk about when we have you on the show. And the first one I want to go with is what happened at the state legislature, because for the most part, it wasn't a whole lot over the past few days, being that they, I think, kind of saw that they have, well, another special session that's going to be coming our way in June. And it's kind of interesting that it almost mirrors what happens in Congress, where Congress can always say, well, we'll just come back and do this legislation later. And now we're kind of seeing the same thing happen at the state legislature, being that with Governor Walz's emergency orders, they're going to be right back at things in June. So what are your thoughts on what happened in the state legislature over the past few days?
Well, let's take us back to January or early February and think about how everything has changed and nothing has changed as a result of COVID-19. If we were back in February, we had about $1.5 billion in an imaginary surplus. And I say imaginary because it didn't really exist, but we had about a $1.5 billion imaginary surplus Democrats wanted to spend money on early childhood education, on some housing. The Republicans wanted to do some tax cuts. We had talk of a big bonding bill, but it was a very partisanly divided legislature. We also had the Democrats who wanted to maybe do some things in terms of legalization of recreational use of marijuana. So that was pretty much the agenda out there. And then what happened is the coronavirus. And what's really fascinating is, again, like I said, how it changed everything and changed nothing. It changed everything in the sense that everything became about the coronavirus. It changed everything in the sense that we went from $1.5 billion in the black to at least $2.5 billion, $2.4 billion in the hole. But we're still what? Partisanly divided. Issues in terms of, let's say, relief for small businesses, the debate over the bonding bill, which was always going to be contentious, was there. So it's questions about trying to make it easier for people to vote by mail coming November elections. All this stuff broke down along a partisan divide. So in many ways, getting to the end of the special session where they yet again couldn't agree, no surprise.
It's kind of funny you put it in those terms, too, because for the first couple of weeks when COVID-19 was really taking hold in Minnesota, where people were really starting to pay attention to it, that was what, like mid-March or so, we did see about a two-week period where we had lots of bipartisan cooperation at the legislature. And then as soon as we hit April, it pretty much went away, especially when we saw another a number of Republicans who weren't happy with the governor's emergency powers. Almost kind of mirrors even what happened post 9/11, except this timeline went even faster, where we had a little bit of a period of bipartisan cooperation, have a crisis, then all of a sudden that goes away and we're back to normal with the usual partisan fighting. So, yeah, as you said, the more thing, it just is back to where we essentially were at the beginning of the session.
No, you're right. And we did have that brief window, but you're right. The contentious issue in the last few weeks, and we're seeing this now, for example, with Jason Lewis, the U.S. Senate candidate, Republican candidate running against Tina Smith, is suing the governor, claiming that the shelter at home, the stay-at-home orders are violating his First Amendment rights. We're seeing this divide over whether the governor has authority or is taking a proper approach in terms of addressing the coronavirus, and that's partly what scuttled the bonding bill. Now, part of it was, I think, a dispute between the fact that the Democrats wanted $2 billion, Senate Republicans want $1 billion, but we had Kurt Dowd, the Republican former Speaker of the House, saying that they weren't going to provide the critical votes for the bonding bill unless the governor rescinded his many of his orders and opened up the state. So just on absolutely everything. In fact, I would go to the point of saying that the fact that in the waning days of the session, Democrats wore masks at the legislature, Republicans didn't, that captured absolutely everything in terms of the divide at the legislature.
So who ends up getting hurt more by not really having any legislation passed over these past few weeks? Because for the most part, it would appear to be Republicans, since we often hear when we look at both chambers of the legislature, the House is very likely to stay with the Democrats while the Senate is very much in play. So you would think that maybe Republicans could potentially be hurt more by not having any legislation passed or not having a bonding bill passed more specifically, since that does help a lot of local communities. Do you think either political party is hurt more by this, or the bigger question is, does it even matter? Does it really just come down to what happens at the presidential level, where we're such a nation that really only pays attention to what happens with the presidency that maybe it doesn't even matter necessarily what the legislature does or does not do? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I still think the presidential election drives absolutely everything. And, the you know, it's going to be a split pattern because I think Republicans could have benefited in greater Minnesota from being able to say that the bonding bill got this building fixed or that leaky thing taken care of or that road paved, et cetera, et cetera. But so could have Democrats. So I think it's kind of mixed. But I think the Republicans took more of a chance because if the public opinion polls are correct, what is it, about an upper 70s, maybe 80% approval rating for Governor Waltz in terms of how he's handling the coronavirus. And I would have to say that that works, I think, to the Democrats' advantage if they can message it properly in terms of saying that The Democrats wanted a bonding bill for jobs. They wanted to protect the health and safety of Minnesotans and support the governor. And the Republicans basically were willing to jeopardize the life and safety of people for opening up the economy or something like that. I think if the Democrats can play it well, they're the winner. But I think one of the traditional problems that Democrats face is not always being the best in terms of messaging.
Yeah, that is the understatement of the year right there. Hey, you were mentioning a few minutes ago that Jason Lewis has, of course, filed a lawsuit against Governor Walz in regards to his emergency powers. And I want to get your thoughts as to whether this lawsuit has any merit, because we've seen several of these other types of legal actions taken around the country with mixed results. Where, of course, in Wisconsin, we saw Governor Evers' emergency order overturned, while in Oregon, we saw the exact opposite happen, where we just had a court ruling that affirmed the governor of Oregon's emergency power. So what are your thoughts on what could happen in Minnesota in terms of how the courts might decide on this lawsuit with Jason Lewis?
Well, I believe, just correct me if I'm wrong, was this case filed in Minnesota courts or federal court?
You know, that is a good question. And while we tap dance who are here, I will try to Google that and figure that out. But
okay.
That is a key point, though.
Yeah, because if it's the Minnesota courts, I think Jason Lewis is likely to lose. And I think the state court system is probably going to uphold most of what Governor Walz does. And I hate to say this but if it goes to the Minnesota Supreme Court, it's a 5-2 divided court right now. And I think the Democrats are democratically appointed justices are likely to support the governor.
Oh, by the way, just to quickly interrupt you here, it was filed in U.S. District Court.
U.S. District Court. So that changes the game a little bit because this raises a very fascinating question here. If he's arguing that his ability, his First Amendment ability to be able to run a campaign is impinged by the governor's order, what it's going to come down to is, can the state of Minnesota show that it had a compelling governmental interest, so overriding of an interest, in this case of protecting the health and safety and welfare of the public, that it overrode Jason Lewis's, let us say, First Amendment rights to campaign and hold rallies. This is going to be interesting in terms of how both sides frame the issue. Lewis doesn't have a completely ridiculous argument in the sense that this order does impinge upon, you know, core First Amendment political rights. And so this again, I will be anxious to see how the briefs and how the arguments play out. But if the governor can make the case that this was a compelling interest to do this, protect safety, the least restrictive way to do it, then I think he's got a better than even chance of prevailing, and Lewis probably will lose. But also keep in mind, as we're speaking, the governor's loosening more and more restrictions. By the time this actually gets to court, the Jason Lewis may not have much of a case.
Yeah, and that's a good point to bring up as well, where this lawsuit could very well end up being a moot point by the time it does work its way through the courts. But even if we look at the makeup of the U.S. District Courts here in Minnesota, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you don't know this off the top of your head, but if I remember correctly, our district has had a number of judges that have been appointed by Republicans over the past few years, where I think we have almost all of those judges who have been Republican appointees. Would that possibly make a difference in terms of how this lawsuit could get ruled on?
And that unfortunately may be true. We're hoping that justice is blind and justice is neutral, but increasingly we're finding that that's not the case, and that there seems to be a partisan breakdown even on the bench anymore. And that would be one of the worries here, I think, for people who are concerned about protecting public health. Will the judges err this time on the side of the First Amendment, or will they err on the side of public health? And this is what makes the case so interesting from a perspective of me as a law professor, is that both sides, I think, in theory, have very compelling and very strong arguments, public health versus First Amendment expressive rights, associational rights, and they both have very, very, very important legitimate basis for being supported. And this is going to be a question of how, again, the courts or how a judge affects the trade-off. At the end of the day, I really don't think, though, that Jason Lewis really cares if he wins. Mm-hmm. This is more of a grandstanding thing anyhow. He sues in court. If he loses, he gets to turn to his base and say, that dirty, rotten governor, that dirty, rotten court, et cetera, et cetera. This is not about winning. This is about getting headlines.
Yeah, you're probably right, because he is certainly looking for those headlines, and he has really framed himself as being the candidate who wants to open everything up, which is definitely putting him in contrast with Tina Smith, his opponent this year. So, yeah, right. I think you're right that the lawsuit is mostly being done, of course, for political reasons. A couple more topics I want to touch on with you here, Professor Schultz, before we do have to wrap things up. And I do briefly want to touch on some national topics. And one of the things I want to talk about is how the Trump campaign has been trying to frame Joe Biden. Because as I look at this, at least so far, they've had some trouble in terms of how they've been trying to paint Joe Biden. We've heard mixed signals with, at first, they've been trying to call him out of touch and confused and not mentally sharp. Then we're hearing ties to the Ukraine and China and so on and so on, where if you look at previous elections, Trump was very successful in 2016, of course, as painting Crooked Hillary. 2012, Obama was very good at painting Mitt Romney as being an out-of-touch corporatist. 2004, George W. Bush, very successful as painting John Kerry as a flip-flopper. Do you think the Trump campaign has had much success thus far trying to paint Joe Biden and really define him ahead of the election?
Not really at this point, and that's kind of interesting, is that, I mean, there's certainly no question that Joe Biden has a series of liabilities. You know, some people would be concerned about his age, or what some people might think is his, let's say, not always coming across well. Some people say maybe coming across as a little feeble. Some people might criticize him for not being progressive enough. But those aren't the things that seem to be really sticking at this point. And Trump has had difficulty. The Ukraine story, is, like you said, is not going anywhere except for his base. And what Trump really needs to do at this point is he needs to get to the independent voters. This is really fascinating. 4 years ago, about 60% of the American public equally disliked Trump and Clinton. But among those kind of swing undecided voters, at the end of the day, they said, well, I dislike Clinton more than I do Trump. I guess I'll vote for Trump. This election, polls are saying that among people who dislike both Biden and Trump, Biden enjoys a huge advantage. And it's a strange way of phrasing it here. And what I mean by that, even if Trump is successful in painting Biden in negative light, people who don't like Biden and don't like Trump are still going to say, I would rather see Biden than I would see Trump. So I'm not sure, even if painting Biden works, it's a successful strategy in the way it was 4 years ago.
And final question for you, and this has to do with more Trump strategy. What we've been seeing from him, of course, a couple of days ago, he announced that he is taking hydroxychloroquine. And whether you believe him or not, that's an entirely different discussion. But this has to be all about distracting from what's happening with Mike Pompeo and those arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He is a master at deflection. So do you think this is largely a strategy he's going to be taking the rest of the way, where he gets a negative story that comes his way and he's just going to go out and say something crazy to distract from the larger issue? What are your thoughts on that?
He's been doing that successfully for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Remember, his whole campaign was a distraction. Blame the immigrants. Blame the Muslims on everything. Now he's blaming what? He's blaming China. He's blaming the World Health Organization on his mishandling of the coronavirus. So I think constantly we've always seen a pattern with him. It's a combination of distraction and egomania. Put them together, and I think in many ways, that defines the Trump presidency.
Yeah, couldn't say it better myself. Unfortunately, you are correct on that, and he unfortunately has been successful in doing that for the past 4 years, even going back to 2015 when he first announced that he was running for office. Hey, that's Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, political science professor, and you can find his writings over at schultzstake.blogspot.com. That's schultzstake.blogspot.com. Hey, Professor Schultz, appreciate the time today.
Anytime. Thank you very much, and thanks to the audience. Bye.
Absolutely. And we'll come on back for one final segment of FYI Politics up next here on AM 950.
At Rudy Luther Toyota, the health and safety of their customers and employees is the top priority. They continue to take extreme precautions to keep everyone safe. Like many businesses in Minnesota, Rudy Luther Toyota is starting to move forward. They have a huge selection of new and certified used Toyotas, and Toyota has announced 0% APR financing for up to 60 months for qualified buyers on several of their most popular models, like my favorite, the new RAV4. You can even take up to 90 days to make your first payment. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 west of Minneapolis, and online at rudyluther.com.
Don't be surprised if you hear your name when you walk into St. Paul Corner Drug. Our experienced staff make getting to know you their top priority. Developing a trusting relationship with our patients is the first step in providing personalized care that achieves the best outcomes possible. Make certain all your providers know who you are and what your needs are. It is a vital step in your well-being. Stop by St. Paul Corner Drug today to start a relationship with a staff that cares. St. Paul Corner Drug, pharmacy the way it should be.
Hi, this is Laura with Food Freedom Radio. And right now, with so much fear, uncertainty, anxiety, and real problems, I mean, people are facing hunger, there's depression, there's anxiety. What else is there? There's climate change, there's the soil going corrupt. How do we connect with each other? How do we take this moment of crisis and take a sad song and make it better? That's what we're talking about every week on Food Freedom Radio. So tune to us Saturdays at 8 a.m. or Sundays at 11 or anytime on podcast, Food Freedom Radio.
Even though these are challenging times, All Energy Solar is still committed to providing you a cost-effective, environmentally friendly energy system through their zero-contact protocol. Solar remains a great value and long-term investment, but some of the incentive programs will be expiring soon. All Energy Solar can walk you through the entire process. They can evaluate your property by phone or webinar, and can even complete preliminary design work without visiting your home. So start saving on your energy bill today and visit allenergysolar.com.
Hi, Gregory Rich, owner of Habitation Furnishing and Design and host of Drinkin' the Style, Saturdays at 7 and Sundays at 5. You know, we're all sitting at home right now, and chances are you've noticed a thing or two that you wish you could change. Well, the Habitation Design staff is here to help. Right now, we're offering free virtual interior design services. It works like this. You guys are home, we're all at home. Let's schedule a virtual walkthrough of your space. Using FaceTime, Zoom, or Skype, one of our degreed professional interior designers will take a look, tell you precisely how to measure your room, then provide you with specific product recommendations, a design plan, and everything you need to make your space beautiful and functional. So we've all got the time. Why don't we take advantage of it? Call Habitation at 952-426-3548. That's 952-426-3548 and schedule your virtual design appointment today.
All right, just less than a minute left in the show, so I want to get to this final story before we move on to Matt McNeil. So, of course, coming up at 3 o'clock, we are expected to get that announcement from Governor Walz on how restaurants can reopen in Minnesota. But a Maryland bar that wants to reopen has unveiled an innovative solution that's going to help patrons social distance. What their plan is to put everyone who comes to their bar in these giant inner tubes to practice social distancing. So that would be 6 feet apart. Isn't that awesome right there? The only
yeah,
thing
just
that,
around their waist?
Yeah, around their waist, literally, like these giant inner tubes. The problem is that you know that's just going to turn into like bumper cars by the end of the night.
With oh, yeah, that would encourage me to get closer to people.
Yeah, that would encourage me to go bump into people, especially with the more you drink. So a nice idea, but probably a swing and a miss right there. All right, we got Matt McNeil coming up next on the show.